views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good yawning this morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, your station for fresh new smart talk all day. It is Monday, the 3rd of February, 2025, and you are on the clock with Erin Green. I'm a little excited this morning, if I could tell y'all why. Saturday, the 1st of February, 2025, marked the fourth anniversary of On the Clock with Erin Green. Now, this week, I want to have a celebratory show. I think I'm going to do it on Wednesday. For the four years, I'm going to have a number of prizes. We got a couple of prizes left over from the On the Clock Guardian Radio AM giveaway, holiday giveaway. So I got a couple of little prizes there, but I got four special prizes for four listeners from On the Clock. And I'm going to talk more about what that prize is on the day of that show. I'm very excited. But most of all, I want to say to the listening audience, thank you for tolerating me. Thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for celebrating and being joyous with me. Thank you for giving gratitude with me. And more importantly, thank you for sitting in the discomfort and sitting with uncomfortable conversations, right? So we can wade through ourselves to something new, something better, something that we didn't think was inside of us. And so to the listening audience, once again, to the watching audience as well, who has to tolerate the looks on my face. If you watch the video, right, then you'll see why I love doing radio, because sometimes I get very animated. I want to say thank you. And if God spare life and if God spare this show, I'm hoping for at least another 4 years, at least. So we've got lots to talk about this morning. A quick housekeeping note, I was hoping to see this story in today's paper, but perhaps I missed it. There were a number of very bad traffic accidents over the last week and this weekend, but there was a bad traffic accident at Goodman's Bay, it appears, yesterday, involving some tourists. I was hoping to see that matter in today's paper, but we haven't. Another quick note, a discussion to be picked up later in the week. Our news featured an event that took place at the end of this week. The news story was titled Reopening. Collins House has officially reopened. The estate once belonged to Ralph Gregory Collins, whose dividing wall historically separated classes and colors in Nassau. Now the historic site is set to be renovated and transformed into a national museum. I will have a conversation about that, if not this week, next week. And the reason for the delay would be I am asking people who sit on, who used to jump over Collins' wall, who used to wake Collins' wall, if you remember stories told to you by your parents or grandparents. Like, I could be honest, I don't know when the wall was built. Do you have a history, a story about the building of the wall? About the time when what the wall was changed, right? In the community, in the country. And so I am gearing up for that conversation. I think Mr. C.A. Newry really should lead that conversation, him being a historian, but I getting excited for it, and I will create a space because I think that's a two-hour show at minimum for that. Lots of texts. Before I read these texts, thank you for that joke. Today we're talking about the criminalization of marital rape. Via Zoom, Miss Alicia Wallace, founder and director of Equality Bahamas. One of the reasons I turned to Equality Bahamas for this conversation is because Equality Bahamas has been advocating for and lobbying for the criminalization of marital rape for a number of years now. They have a campaign, a consistent campaign for the criminalization of marital rape. And so I've invited Ms. Wallace to join us to talk about the Strike 5 campaign to criminalize marital rape and to discuss the Attorney General's comments on marital rape at the UB Legal Week 2025. Good morning, Ms. Wallace.
Good morning, Erin, and congratulations on 4 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much. As, like I say, if God spare life and spare this show, then me and my Chikchanis, we're going to come to the station every day for a conversation. Today's conversation, I think, is timely. What I'd like to do initially is have you remind us what Equality Bahamas is, and then what the Strike 5 campaign is, and I have some questions, and then we'll move into Equality Bahamas' response to marital rape. After you tell us what 5 campaign is, I want to just list some articles that I think would be great for the audience who has been following the marital rape conversation. So I have articles from Friday, the most recent public discourse on or state discussion on the matter. And then I have stories starting from June 2022, I think. We have a lot of stories, but from April 2024 to May 2024, with commentary from policymakers and advocates about the issue. So, good morning, Ms. Wallace. Tell us, learn us just a little brief bit about Equality Bahamas.
Equality Bahamas is a feminist organization that is working to promote women, people's rights as human rights. We have been primarily focusing on gender-based violence, looking at it not only in terms of interpersonal violence, but looking at structural violence, which includes laws that discriminate on the basis of sex and gender in particular. We were founded in 2014, and the issues that we have worked on since then include domestic violence very broadly, the educational campaign we ran for 2 years ahead of the 2016 referendum on nationality rights and sex-based discrimination. Of course, the Strike 5 campaign to criminalize marital rape. And, you know, every year there seem to be more issues that are very connected to this issue of gender-based violence. And we realize that we can't separate them out from what we are doing and from the feminist futures that we're building. So as an example, in 2019, when Hurricane Dorian took place, we found ourselves expanding our work to include climate justice and looking at the ways that it interacts us. The Strike 5 campaign to criminalize marital rape started officially in 2018. So we're going into 7 years of talking about this issue, of advocating, really pressing various government administrations to criminalize marital rape and making it clear to them that we know, and also making it clear to the public that this is not a complicated issue. We already know the changes that need to be made to the Sexual Offenses Act. In fact, the 2022 draft amendment bill does most of those things, including adjusting the definition of rape in the Sexual Offenses Act in Section 3. Removing those words, who is not his spouse, which is where we get the name of our campaign, Strike 5. We need to strike those five words from the definition. That's the first step to criminalizing marital rape.
Mm-hmm. So the Strike Five, well, the Strike Five campaign would have begun in, well, began in 2018. For the criminalization of marital rape existed well before Equality Bahamas began its campaign. I want to read a quote from one of our local, one of the articles I'm going to read from today. Whether there is a concern about losing votes, the Attorney General said, quote, "I think every administration in the history of the Bahamas who has put this on the table and had it in front of it is worried about the same issue. There's nothing unique about this. There's a reason that no administration has passed it, and every single administration has drafted a bill. Every single one." In conversation in a WhatsApp group, let me rephrase this. I don't want to feign or pretend a familiarity. But in a broad conversation about marital rape, Mr. Sean McQueenie, KC, indicated that marital rape was on the table, a part of the debate for the 1991 Sexual Offenses and Domestic Violence Act, but it was a very contentious issue, extremely contentious, and some religious leaders. And that the policymakers, the legislators at the time, felt that although it was an extremely important issue, that they needed to press on with the other reforms present in that 1991 Sexual Offenses and Domestic Violence Act, which included the criminalization of incest. Right, for one of those issues. So to make the point that this is not a new debate, it's not a new legal or social or cultural issue being tackled or engaged by policymakers. The AG, the Attorney General, said, quote, "I think every administration in the history of the Bahamas who has put this on the table and had it in front of it worried about the same issue. There is a reason that no administration, a single administration, has drafted a bill, every single one." Ms. Wallace, Equality Bahamas' response to the Attorney General's statements, I can read the headline, "Attorney General, Government Won't Move Forward with Marital Rape." That's the 31st, that's Friday, January 2025. Another from the Tribune: "Marital rape laws not expected by end of term." And in today's Tribune, activists criticize government of being, quote, "spineless," close quotes, on marital rape bill. What has been Equality Bahamas' response?
We note that this is indeed not unique, and not necessarily in the same ways that the Attorney General considers it to be not unique. It is common practice for government administrations to simply do what is easy. You just in the 90s. And it is always at the expense of people in situations of vulnerability. This idea of political expediency, but also prioritizing personal ambition of politicians themselves, sitting MPs and cabinet ministers, over the work that they are put in those positions to do. It always seems to be about the next election cycle and securing their seats, mm-hmm. and not with securing the dignity and the safety of the people in the Bahamas.
So let me stick a pin there just for a second, because I'm sure a number of people are saying that a politician's job, a cabinet minister, an MP's job is to lead for the majority and not the minority. In this instance, I think it doesn't matter what your personal perspective or even professional, like professional political or policymaker position is on criminalization of marital rape in a democracy, an inherent principle is that even though the majority decides, you can never ignore the minority. You can never invisibilize the minority. And even in a decision of the minority must be considered. And the provisions that exist from constitution to ordinary legislation must be used to protect the minority and ensure equal and equitable access or protection, right? From the law or to the law.
Absolutely. And we are consistently reminding the government of the Bahamas of its ratification of various international human rights mechanisms, including United Nations human rights mechanisms like CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And it's important that we keep talking about these mechanisms. We keep talking about CEDAW and with the understanding that it is for states, including the Bahamas, to participate in these processes and to adopt and to ratify various instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Bahamas ratified CEDAW in 1993 is an indication to us that the government is aware of its obligations to protect, uphold, expand, and guarantee full access to human rights for everyone, including and specifically women and girls.
All right. So is spineless too strong of a word?
No, I use it over and over again because it is a valid, true representation of what we are seeing. I mean, there are other words that I could use too, including cowardly.
Okay. That's a strong word.
What else could we say about the statements that are being made and the demonstration that we are seeing where it is to massage the egos of people who have perceived or real influence over voters, prioritizing that over actually performing the functions of your job and meeting the needs of the people and doing what you know that you need to do because the bill is already drafted. The Attorney General said there are many drafts. He has them all, but they're still not pushing it forward. And why? Because they are afraid of anti-rights groups.
Are they afraid of, well, anti-rights groups, lobbyists? Is there a distinction between the groups that you call anti-rights groups and the people that those groups purport to represent?
Absolutely. There's absolutely a difference. We see that there are people who have a certain amount of influence and a certain amount of power that comes with that influence. And it is not only used in one direction to push or to pull governments in certain directions, but also pulling people within the constituency itself. And we as individuals, as citizens, as residents, as members of particular institutions can fall prey to this misuse of power when we don't take the steps needed to study for ourselves and to understand our own beliefs, why we believe what we do, what our values are, what our responsibilities are as people who are living or supposed to be living in community with one another. When we look to other people to interpret the law, to interpret religious text for us, instead of doing that work, we do ourselves a disservice and we end up doing the same disservice and actually causing danger and putting threats to other people.
All right. Producer, can you turn up Ms. Wallace's mic, please? Or Ms. Wallace, could you speak up just a bit louder from one of the audience members is asking via text. Okay, so I'm wearing two hats in this conversation in this moment right now, one your personality and then one as an advocate. I doubted the sincerity of any proclamation by state actors that the state was fully and wholly committed to this, right? A, that the PLP or the Davis administration, the PLP party was committed to it, or that the Davis administration, if elected and once elected, was committed to it. A part of that reasoning for me, or reconciling for me, coming to that conclusion, was this: the lack of clarity from state actors, in particular the prime minister, right? The lack of sound, coherent, and clear statements from the ministers responsible, right? That lack of clarity was clear to me that there was a lack of political will, and then subsequently a lack of capacity to create the collective will, right? And here's what I mean, not the collective will for everybody to vote the same way, you know. That's not what I mean. Like the government's ability to cause everybody to agree, but the government's ability to curate or create a national or collective conversation, coherent conversation, that the broader public, and specifically the electorate, those who vote, could understand the state's position, the party's position, the various actors, MPs, who become cabinet ministers' positions on the matter. When I saw that there was a complete lack of clarity and coherence in that space, I knew that it was unlikely that the Davis administration would achieve this thing. Ms. Wallace?
Yes, there always seems to be that lack of clarity, and it is connected, as you said, to the lack of political will. And it's very telling that we have to question every time a bill or a proposal is put forth whether or not there is real interest in it by even the people who are presenting it to us. Whether the administration, whether the opposition, you know, what are their positions? We can't really be clear. And this is one of the issues that comes up in international periodic reviews of human rights mechanisms. So we hear from the CEDAW committee, we also hear through the Universal Periodic Review, experts and other UN member states asking the Bahamas, what are you doing to ensure that there are educated conversations around that rights holders, people who have rights, which is all of us, understand their rights and understand your obligation as the government to ensure that they have access to them? Because there is an understanding that if people don't understand their rights and how they're supposed to access them, they're much less likely to go after them. And it works to the government's advantage over and over again to keep us in the dark and to not let us know what our rights are. And here, within the context of the criminalization or the lack of criminalization of marital rape, as we're discussing now, one of the issues that we have is not having had a sustained conversation about violence against women in particular, and about gender-based violence against women, the different forms that it takes, and the other factors involved that do or do not have an effect on that violence and how we perceive the violence. So we can look at relationships. We can talk about the study that we bring up all the time that was done with, I believe it was the College of the Bahamas at the time, with the Crisis Center, where they spoke to or they surveyed high school students, and the majority thought that it was appropriate for a man or a boy to quote unquote discipline a woman or a girl that they're in relationship with. That is cause for pause, right? That is something that really needs to be investigated. Something is very wrong for teenagers to think that they should have control over people that they're in relationship with and that they are right in enacting violence against them. It raises the question of what is happening within the home and what we're being taught about relationships, about intimate partner relationships, and what we're taught about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
What is the reason that so many people want to defend rape in the context of marriage?
It, Okay, a whole bunch of stuff here. Let's start with the text I got in. It says, we can't criminalize marital rape because in the Bahamas, we have no clue what rape is. In an example in the U.S., touching a woman on her body is rape. In the Bahamas, it's normal. The text is right about a broader or wider definition of sexual violence, right, against people. Let's remember that although we're talking about gender-based violence and towards women, because in this instance, those who oppose the criminalization of marital rape speak only about a fear that women will falsify their victimhood in an attempt to destroy men, right? But
they talk about that, but they also talk about the dominance of men and that men should have whatever they want and that women are the property of men and must, quote unquote, submit.
See, I'm a strange bird. So I believe I'm a Golan, right? And I see that on the surface. I see that the men clinging to what some people call trope, what some people call dom, people call what has been from time upon time, that men are to be dominant, men are in control. But I think a lot of men actually cling to that, right, in an attempt to bolster their masculinity, because within them, the man, right, because they're clearly men, big man, within them, a part of them, the little boy, right? And I think there is a subconscious clinging to that trope that men are to be dominant because that little boy that still exists within the man, and I'm not denigrating men, right? Within women, there's still a little girl. Within men, there's still a little boy, a part of you. And I think that part of some men, not all men, they are deathly concerned, right? Point of a phobia that the women in their lives, the wives, right, are being enabled to abuse them in the same way that their mothers were, quote unquote, enabled to abuse them, in the sense that mothers may have been abusive to sons and nobody stood up to protect the boy. Something as simple as you just look like you're no good, pa. Right? What you good for? Sometimes it's physical abuse. We know that a lot of young boys, boy children, and young men infantilized by excessive and unnecessary physical abuse. Right? Where mothers think they gotta beat down their sons to maintain the authority. In my heart, I believe that some of these men cling to that patriarchal trope because of a fear or concern that, or observation that their wives are allowed by society to treat them the same way their mothers did. And so, in our approach to this matter, should we shift focus from policymakers and shift focus to the makers of culture?
They definitely both need to be involved. And there, I think what you're pointing to is a set of mental health needs, right? Mm-hmm. Because it is not the fault of the woman that a man has had particular experiences in his life. And it is not an excuse for violence or for men excusing violence or trying to maintain conditions that allow them to enact violence without consequence. I think it's very important that we're careful about the way that we lay out some of the factors that inform and create the conditions that we're living in, mm-hmm. separating that out from what can be perceived to be excuses or validation of, mm-hmm. of their positions. And I want to be very clear that there is no excuse for violence. There's no excuse for advocating for violence or trying to maintain these very harmful, very dangerous conditions that disproportionately affect people in situations of vulnerability, which include women, young people, people with disabilities, people who are migrants, particularly those that are undocumented, and the ways that so many people seek to hold power over other people so that they can feel bigger or so that they can maintain a particular position. And I'm talking about the people who are enacting interpersonal violence, and I'm talking about the people that are enacting or by their words, by words they don't say, by things they don't do, supporting systems that are violent, structural violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very, very important conversation. A conversation that is simultaneous with the advocacy and the policy lobbying work, right? Normally, I call you all in, I call Equality Bahamas in to talk about policy, right? And to talk about your policy work. And in reference to my earlier question, right? And I wanted to frame it, which comes first, you know, policy or culture, the chicken or the egg. But what is the, or give us some examples of the other types of work that Equality Bahamas is doing in this space, right? To reflect that the policy work and the culture work has to take place at the same time.
It's a great point that you're making. It's not linear. This process isn't linear, and we know that culture informs behavior even in the ways that we change all of these things, and where it's constantly evolving, even if we don't want to recognize it. Mm-hmm. One of the areas that we started working on in the last 2 years is parental leave. And we have been in conversations in various ways with people who have given birth in the last few years and the people who have supported them. Mm-hmm. Talking about what that was like. What was the postpartum experience like? How much leave did you get? What was your experience when you returned to work? Did your partner have leave? How much was it paid? What did it look like to be supported physically in the same space with somebody who was able to take time off? And what was it like when you did not have that, for those who didn't have that kind of mm-hmm. support, didn't have that privilege, which really should be a right? And those experiences, those stories have really informed the policy recommendations that we're preparing to make this year about parental leave. So we're looking at maternity leave, but also looking at paternity leave. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we wanted to focus on this in particular is that we recognize the relationship between the law and culture and our behavior and gender dynamics. We mm-hmm. understand that it's still expected that women take on the domestic and care work. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And we have moved far beyond the place where men went out to work and women stayed at home and all they had to do was manage the household. Now women are doing it all, going out to work 40 hours a week or more, and then coming back to what we call the second shift. Mm-hmm. How do we change this dynamic? How do we shift that culture? How do we make it so that men and boys are participating in this work and children are being raised with more than one parent, right? It might not even be two parents, because often we have grandparents and aunties and uncles who are involved in that. How do we create a space where it is our norm and it is celebrated, supported, that both parents are as involved as we expect and we see women being today? And we connect that to the law, and we understand that, you know, from the beginning, the mother gets time off and the father doesn't. So we're already setting up the expectations that mom is responsible for the baby. Mm-hmm. So a part of shifting that is ensuring that we have parental leave that can be shared. So that's one example of policy that we're looking at, and the ways that laws and cultures and behavior are connected.
Now, and here's a direct connection to the criminalization of marital rape campaign. When we begin to talk about parental leave, when we begin to talk about maternal leave and paternal leave, right, then we create a space where men are more receptive to this conversation about postpartum sex or intercourse and intimacy. right? Because one of the instances where the question of marital rape arises is when a postpartum mother, a mother who's just given birth, is saying, my husband won't wait. My husband insists that we must be sexually intimate almost right away. He's pestering me, and when I tell him no, he takes it. I just want to stick in a little history right here. The mother of the Honorable A.D. Hannah, Bertha Hannah, I may be getting the name wrong, but I think I'm correct, was known as a maternity advocate, a family but it was broader than that. It wasn't just mother's rights. It wasn't just children's rights. It was family rights. Because in Acklands, she insisted that families wait, right? Essentially, the husbands wait at least 2 years between births, right? To give 2 years between births for the health of the mother, but also the health of the child, health of the family, right? In a broader sense of health. And so when we have a conversation about parental rights, maternal rights, and paternal rights, then we're creating a space where men and women are more receptive to, and a conversation about consent and marital rape is more accessible. Ms. Wallace?
Yes, making these connections is critical to people getting this understanding and being able to see the humanity in one another.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Ms. Wallace, producer, let's go to a break. When we come back from the break, Ms. Wallace, I'm going to read through some texts, and then I want to read at the very least a headline and an excerpt from a number of articles over the last 10 to 11 months about marital rape, what our state actors are saying, what our local advocates are saying. Still 96.9 FM, you're on the clock with Erin Green. We'll be right back.
Alpha Sounds Promotion presents Back to Love, an unforgettable evening of smooth R&B vibes and cherished memories. Join us at the Nassau Cruise Port on Saturday, February 15th for a spectacular all-white affair featuring live performances by soul sensations, Freddie Jackson.
Everybody, it's Freddie Jackson. I'm coming to Nassau, Bahamas, and we are looking forward to the night of love.
Also performing, Regina Bell. Also featuring Bahamas' very own Essence Band. Back to Love, Saturday, February 15th.
It's a spectacular all-white affair
at the Nassau Cruise Port. Get tickets online. Bahama Plantation Bar and Grill, Big Boys Cafe, and Tropics Bar and Grill.
For more info, contact 822-6863.
And I hope to see you there.
Reliable and impactful printing services, look no further. Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life. We stand by our quality products that is second to none. Our affordable pricing and friendly, efficient staff makes Printmasters the ultimate choice for all your printing needs. We can deliver any type of printing services, from banners to booklets to business cards. You name it, we can print it.
Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life.
Located at the Nassau Guardian Building, telephone 302-2361.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Good morning and welcome back to On the Clock with Erin Green. We are back. Good morning, Ms. Wallace. Welcome back. Okay. So, I got a lot of texts here, dear Texas. I'm not even sure. Okay, I can read one of the texts, Ms. Wallace. You ready?
Ready.
It says, I can't see myself lobbying with Ms. Wallace on people she worried about is the illegal migrants and Rainbow Coalition. Suck my teeth. I think they meant the only people you worried about. Don't respond to it. Let me respond to it. Dear Texter, when Ms. Wallace spoke about earlier about some of Equality Bahamas' work, and in particular when she spoke about their work intersecting with climate justice, one of the things Equality Bahamas did immediately post Hurricane Dorian was partner with Lend a Hand Bahamas. And I'm not sure the relationship with any state agencies or other local NGOs or civil society actors, but Equality Bahamas, in collaboration with Lend a Hand Bahamas, ran a post-Dorian distribution center for months, if not weeks upon weeks. You know, I'm going to speak to it that there is an inherent intersection of rights, right? That means everybody has to have equal and equitable access to protections, right? And so sometimes our work intersects. But, I mean, gay people could be married in heterosexual relationships, right? A person who is gay can make a decision to be in a heterosexual marriage and experience marital rape. These things can happen. Ms. Wallace?
Yeah, there's no need to exclude anyone. And there are already so many people, so many systems, so many organizations that seek to exclude and be very exclusive about the work that they do for particular groups of people. And we at Equality Bahamas are very intentional about working to support and to advocate for the rights of all women, women and girls in all their diversity. So that means women with disabilities. That means women who are lesbians. That means women who are migrants. If you are here in the Bahamas and you are a woman, or you are an LGBTQI plus person, or you are a migrant, you are a person and you have human rights. And we are here to talk about your human rights and to advocate for human rights.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a discussion that we kind of picked up last week where someone gave us a definition, a distinction between the use of the term driftwood and the use of the term seaweed on family islands. And it's a conversation about internal migration, right? And the one thing that the COVID pandemic raised was a question of citizens' migration rights. Like, I have a right to move throughout the archipelago of the Commonwealth of the Bahamas freely, right, from island to island. Does the state have a right, or are they allowed to restrict my movement in a way suggesting, like, if I'm from New Providence, then I need authorization to go to another island? You know, all of these conversations are important. And even when we don't see ourselves in the experience of the people or the group who's being centered in the conversation, there are things that will, for people on the fringe of the conversation as well.
Absolutely.
So, Ms. Wallace, in our last few minutes, I want to walk through some headlines and excerpts from articles in the media on the subject matter, right? And I'm going to start from today. In today's Tribune, we have the article, Activists Criticize Government of Being, quote, spineless, close quotes, on marital rape bill. In today's Nassau Guardian, we have a letter to the editor, A Duty to Protect Human Rights, written by Chris Minnis from Exuma, Bahamas. And then in my notes from Friday's paper, we have AG, government won't move forward with marital rape. Another article, marital rape laws not expected by end of term. A great from Friday's paper as well. A producer prepped a call. We take one call as we go out. This headline is Gomez, law allowing immunity for marital rape address. And this is excerpts from Damian Gomez Casey's presentation at UB Legal Week 2025. Good morning, caller.
Good morning to you and good morning to your guest, Erin Johnson.
Morning, sir.
Just let me just say something. You know, the biggest problem I've seen over the last decade is that we always have these conversations in singularity as opposed to dealing with a piece. There's a straight line for protection that we need to have a conversation of in total context. And we often conflate and convolute the various different things, even from the constitutional issue. The question we have to do is just easily just put down on the list laws that do not protect males and laws that do not protect females, regardless of the age.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can subcategorize those. But when you talk about the marriage laws from the early 1900s or 1800s, that's where we have a problem in the Bahamas, because we could very easily, before we reach the stage of marital rape, it seems as if though we're trying to protect marriage to remain when it begins to pose a threat to the safety and sanctity and whatever else of the people in those relationships. Update the marriage laws to allow legal separation, because long before the rape occurs, there's a pathway to that. No one is in a happy, wholesome relationship and the husband or wife gets up the next morning and say, I want to rape or sexually abuse a significant other. There is signs, but we don't give way out, which is a no-fault divorce, a legal separation that could happen within a day or whatever, that when served on the other person, lets them know that they are no longer under the protection of marriage. These are simple solutions. I don't know why we try to put this complexity into it. And I don't care what the church says. And let's use this point. The church will say they want to save marriage. Good. When you get a legal separation that separates the right of access, the church will have whatever amount of time until the divorce happened to reconcile that relationship. But that legal separation ends the right to do anything and it ends the regular assault laws. Thank you so much.
Thank you, C. Allen. That's a very interesting... Go on, Ms. Wallace.
On the first point, there has been the beginning of work
mm-hmm.
on identifying all of the laws that discriminate
mm-hmm.
against anyone of any gender. That was undertaken quite a while back. I believe the forum was held in early 2022. UN Women, the multi-country office for the Caribbean, was engaged to do that, and we have yet to see the final report on that. I have been following up with UN Women as well as the Department of Gender and Family Affairs every month or so, asking mm-hmm. about this document. We still don't have it. So those that are interested, get in touch with the Department of Gender and Family Affairs and see what's going on with that, because it would be very useful to see all of the laws and the ways that they discriminate and all of the remedies that we need to bring.
Absolutely. Thank you. Ms. Wallace, I got a text that says, good morning, Erin. The idea of marital rape is utter foolishness. Husband and wife belong to each other, and I agree with C. Allen. I'm not sure if you were listening to exactly what C. Allen was saying, but that's okay. Ms. Wallace, I need to let you go so I could say something tongue-in-cheek. I do not want to trivialize, right, or the quality of the work that Equality Bahamas does by involving you in my final commentary. But I hope to pick up this conversation with Equality Bahamas shortly, because I think the conversation is still going to be front and foremost in the media. Hopefully in the hour with Guardian Radio AM, Mr. Newry is going to continue talking about this subject and we can go through some of these texts. I just wanted to make this point that in this conversation with Equality Bahamas, we have focused on, I guess, like one side of the marital rape discussion. Not like, oh, only for people who are proponents of criminalizing it versus criminalizing it. No, that's not what I mean. What I mean is we've only really spoken about criminalization of marital rape in the interest of protecting women or for the purpose of protecting women. I just want to remind you all that men are also victims of rape. They can be raped by other men and by women. Men also experience marital rape, and they also have no recourse in the law. And so let us just pray that women don't feel that they have a license to abuse their husbands in the ways that some men think that Christian doctrine will protect them if they do violate their female spouse. Been on the clock with Erin Green. I think I may just have to marry one man and see what we could do. Y'all have a great day, Bahamas.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, streaming on GuardianTalkRadio.com and the Guardian Radio app, Nassau, Bahamas.